Welcome to the Technoid Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Joining me on today's show, Amir Haleem, CEO, co-founder of Helium. You might know the company Helium. They've just announced that they raised about $15 million, which is a total of more than, I want to say, $51 million. And that includes, you know, major groups, GV, Coastal Ventures, Mark Benioff, obviously Salesforce, a ton of other capital partners. One of the people who is the co-founder of this company, you might know from the Napster days, Sean Fanning. Amir is the CEO and he's the co-founder of this company. Listen, we don't even do a startup inbox on the show because this one goes long as it is. So I'm just going to keep this extraordinarily brief, which is hard to do because we covered a ton. We talk about Libra and Facebook's new crypto and the impact of it because it really does sort of tide the way over to getting into blockchain and how it's useful in a lot of areas. And in the particular case of Helium, Amir probably would cringe as I say this, but it's like the Airbnb of network coverage. It enables you to provide others with network access. As you'll learn when you listen, the 5G dream is going to be very difficult. It's not what the Apple commercial makes it out to be. It's not as easy. It's very expensive. It could cost billions or trillions of dollars infrastructure. And that pretty much leaves the average Joe and anyone in rural America across the world too, out. And Helium can make a big change. And not only can they help enable us to be able to use connectivity across the world, but also profit from it as individuals. We can own a hub and be that little node that people sign on and use my network hub to transmit data and get paid for it transactionally, just like you would if you were, you know, mining for crypto. So not naturally, we started off by talking about crypto and sort of Facebook. And well, to say it, I don't know if it devolved or derailed. It just turned into a really, really fascinating conversation. If you listen to my show, you know the best ones have always been the ones that have absolutely no direction. It just sort of goes. This is one of them. I think Amir leaves a bunch of great tidbits along the way about how his unfair advantage going forward was that his dad, you know, worked in the industry that enabled him to have a computer at a very young age, you know, decade before anybody else. And that's a huge leg up. And another common, you know, kind of denominator of success is dropped out of college because he wanted to pursue something. And that was sort of arrogant, but also just more proof that there's just, I don't know, there's something that drives people to do big things. Was a gamer. We talk about on the show how I think that the early access to computer and then gaming and then also an early acquisition that he was a part of. He was working for a company that got acquired. He wasn't the CEO or anything, but he got to witness it firsthand. I think those things, when you rub them together, have a lot of reaction, and it's what makes people like Amir successful. And well, I certainly learned a lot about Amir and Helium and just being an entrepreneur in general, and I think you will too. So I will skip all of the rest of the plugs and promotions, and I'm just going to jump right to the show. This is my conversation with Amir Haleem, CEO, co-founder, Helium.
Thanks for having me.
No, of course. This is it's really cool. I'm congratulations on the recent announcement for your raise. You guys, you know, obviously have been on a tear and are filled with, you know, great investors, obviously. And then I think the timing of this interview really is quite perfect, given the fact that, you know, not related to you, but just from an interest standpoint, you know, Facebook announcing Libra and Calibra and like how that whole thing's going to work out. I think it's just an interesting time, and I'm really looking forward to learning more from you. So just your thoughts on that whole thing.
Awesome. Yeah, I read the white paper this morning, laying in bed, so I've got some I got some knowledge about it.
Yeah, I mean, so let's start with that. Like, where are you at in the? Obviously, I know you guys are pretty heavily in blockchain and crypto, but like, I always find it interesting. I had a conversation with the CTO of Ripple, and I was blown away about how. Obviously, I'm sure you're very aware of this, the trolls and things out there on every social media platform. They speak one way about crypto. There's almost a certain way that you're like, makes me feel uneasy. And when you talk to the actual operators in the space, like the folks at Ripple or even, you know, in your space for blockchain, there's a tactical sort of feel and approach and how they look at things. I'm just curious, when you think of crypto based on your knowledge base, like where are you at? What do you see when you see Libra?
Yeah, it's a complicated space. I mean, I think it's really difficult, even for people embedded in it, like us, to sort of parse what is good and bad. Like, it's a really You know, I think the sort of ICO boom of the 2017 era sort of made it really, really hard. It both brought a lot of like cash into the space and also a lot of like public awareness. So I think like everyone is now aware of Bitcoin and to some degree Ethereum and these other things. But certainly brought in with it a lot of noise. And I think filtering like signal from noise is just generally really hard in this space particularly. But Libra, I think, is super interesting, not necessarily because of the technology, although it doesn't look like they've thought about it very deeply, and I'm sure it's extremely well architected. I haven't spent enough time looking at it to say anything definitively there, but mostly because it will be like this gigantic on-ramp for people into the cryptocurrency world, right? It's like today it's still a very niche, sort of early adoptery kind of thing, and I think something like Libra has the potential to sort of very seamlessly like transform the way people interact with money, right? Like you may, as far as I understand it, you may use Libra in, you know, Uber or as part of your like eBay experience. And I see like Visa and MasterCard in there. Maybe there's, you know, they just get built into this card somehow. So I think there'll be this sort of way that people like interact with crypto without them even really knowing that they're doing that, right? And I think that's very powerful and could lead to some sort of high-value, like, knock-on effects that benefit the whole crypto ecosystem in general.
I got to tell you, I think you're totally correct. And so this is so funny. Just this morning, I was talking to a couple of people on the way into the city who know nothing about cryptocurrency. And every time it even gets brought up, it just like you could see their face start to like unravel because the idea is just so ridiculous to them. And I will tell you, the first thing they came in, they're like, because they're obviously older, so I'm trying not to be ageist here. But they spent a lot of time on Facebook, and so this news reached them, and it was like, so tell me, how does this make it easier for me to sell stuff in marketplace? How does this make it easier for me to buy stuff in marketplace and or other, you know, and not, you know, have to sign out and go to PayPal or to do whatever? And it's the first time in, you know, since I mean, I've been attuned to crypto since probably 2014. I would say I was like really paying attention, like obviously when, like everybody else, when it started to take off. But that's the first time anyone of that age has ever come to me and been like, how might this apply to me? And I feel like that is, to your point, is like, is the game changer. That is that moment that could ultimately, you know, have a huge impact on whether or not mass adoption takes place. And that to me is very fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if you thought about Facebook in particular, I mean, you know, just having sort of like dabbled with some of this stuff in the past, like, you know, they've always had credits or like some sort of quasi currency inside Facebook that was used inside games and, you know, other stuff. But this is, you know, this feels, and I'm sure very intentionally, very different. And this sort of desire to sort of onboard this, this sort of set of applications and this sort of foundational structure, I think is very telling in the sense that they, ultimately, the purpose of this, I think, is to replace the U.S. dollar as a mechanism for transacting online, right? And to some degree, that's like long overdue, right? I mean, I use PayPal fairly often, and it's expensive, right, from a relative basis. And so, to sort of your point, like, how does it make it easier for me to like sell stuff in marketplace? It will be in the form of like ease and transaction speed and like lower transaction costs and, you know, all of that stuff that is sort of very, very deeply hidden away somewhere. But I think that's, like I said, I think that's extremely powerful. And it's obviously a very different end of the spectrum to something like Bitcoin, which is, you know, strict state-free money to some extent, or a store of value if you want to, you know, have that argument. But it's a very, you know, very different positioning and a very different purpose, I think, at the end of the day.
The last question I got for you on this before we move on to, you know, actual business that you're in. You're obviously an operator in the space and are obviously well aware of all of the, not all, but most of the capabilities, I'm sure, of blockchain and things like that. How do you view cryptocurrencies compared to, so like I look at the people who run around buying Ferraris with their Bitcoin gains of 2017 and 16, and they're looking at just volatility. Versus someone like I was mentioning before from Ripple, who looks at it from a tactical standpoint of like, what can we do with this? How do you view investing in cryptocurrencies, whether that's good or bad?
I mean, I think it's exactly the right split you've sort of laid out there, right? It is for companies like us and Ripple and sort of anyone that's taking this seriously, to for want of a better way of describing it. you have to be pretty tactical about it because it's an extraordinary amount of work to do it well, right? I mean, like to implement a system like ours, you know, on a blockchain is like thousands of times more complicated than not, right? And so if there isn't a good reason to do it that way, you're wasting a lot of time. And so it's a very different end of the spectrum from, you know, cryptocurrency investors that, you know, I'll never understand, for example, what the purpose of like Litecoin is. And I can already imagine people like getting mad at me on Twitter for saying something like that, but it really, you know, it doesn't.
Well, it's up to 136 bucks right now. So, you know, they're okay until it's not.
Right. I just don't get why, you know what I mean?
And I don't either.
That's the thing, right? It's like it inherently doesn't seem to add a lot of value. I've heard the like silver to the Bitcoin gold and the, you know, it's Bitcoin's testnet. I've heard all the arguments for it.
But those don't, to me, those don't stack up, right? I mean, that's like a really, it sounds really smart. You know what I mean? It's like one of those things you're like, oh, of course. Well, but of course. But if you think right. about it, you're like, I'm not a stupid person. This doesn't, like, I'm with you in this. I don't understand. Like Ethereum, I get only because I see different applications to it. And I'm like, I don't know why I invest in it. I think I just bought like $1,000 worth and just left it there. Like, hey, you know, maybe shit happens. And similar for Bitcoin. Like I get it. I understand a marketplace, but I look at that and I just am a little bit like, why are all these altcoins and Litecoin and Tron and like all the, why are they going up and down? I don't even know why some of them exist, let alone invest in them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, like Bitcoin is to me still the best possible like example of what a cryptocurrency should be, right?
Yes.
I mean, this thing's been around for a decade. There's all the incentive in the world to like hack it and break it and manipulate it, and no one has succeeded. And I think that's like testament to just really a genius design. And you know, for all the critics of proof of work and you know how much energy it uses and everything else about Bitcoin mining, like it is why it is so secure and so great. And so there's definitely like a huge difference. And now actually, like if you look at like the crypto markets, like there's actually a decoupling between like Bitcoin and everything else, which I think is great. Right, because
totally. To
your point, like I have no idea what Litecoin is for. Ethereum, I get. I actually really respect the idea there, like
yep.
to try and create this sort of like programmable money or like world computer or whatever you want to call it. It's actually a really interesting experiment. Whether it will succeed or not seems very debatable. But there's definitely a big difference between like should you invest in the thing and like what it's for. And you know, should you invest in Litecoin? I don't know. Maybe it seems to go up for some reason, but it's different than like, do you actually find it useful or valuable? And that's kind of a very dangerous like speculative volatility play, right? Like if you can't even explain why you're buying Litecoin other than it's going up, that's sort of weird, right?
It's definitely an awkward position that I just don't get. I have young people on my team and they're all over it. I'm like, what the hell? Like, I'm glad that you're making money. I don't know how you are, but I'm glad you are. Let's move on to some stuff that's a little bit more about you and the company, because I can already tell from talking to you just a short period of time that you're a very thoughtful person and that you're a person who's driven sort of by curiosity and things like that. I'd love to know sort of like, you know, where you're from, what your parents did, like how did you come to this position in life?
Wow.
Small question. We start real small.
Yeah. How do I even start with that? So my dad, when I was young, was an executive at Commodore. Do you remember
yes,
Commodore?
Yes,
you,
yes, I do.
Maybe you're old enough. You sound young, so I don't know.
Well, I appreciate that. I haven't slept in days. I have a newborn, so I'm like, I feel like I'm 1,000 years old today, but yeah, I'm 35, so I'm somewhat like in the middle of things.
Yeah, no, I feel your pain on the newborn also. But yeah, my father when I was young was an executive at Commodore, and so they like made the Commodore 64, and before that the PET. So I think the PET was like the first home computer I think that ever existed. Mm-hmm. We had one in our house when I was, you know, whatever, 3 or 4 or something. And so I had always grown up around computers, like it just fascinated by them. I thought they were just an incredible thing. And when I first heard about the internet before there was like really web browsers and stuff like that, I was similarly fascinated with it. But so I was always very fortunate and sort of privileged to have access to like computers, right? Because not everyone did at that time, and still not everyone does. But that sort of led me down this path. And he was like a sort of mechanical and I think electrical engineer by study. And So I learned sort of programming from him, or like basic forms of programming. I got very interested in video games during that time, which actually like led me down an interesting career path. Like I started playing Doom very competitively, and then I started playing Quake very competitively, and took that into like sort of the professional realm, where, you know, I was actually a Quake champion at one point in my life, and then a Quake 3 champion. And I did that very seriously for a long period of time, like before esports was really a big thing the way it is now.
I was part of that, by the way. I was part of that same world. I was a Call of Duty person who built our first sort of like little troop, and we got, I think we ended up getting into like the top 1,000 rankings in the player to player mode. But I used to definitely, it was like my life for a small period of time.
And the interesting thing about it at that time was that it was very different than it is now. Like the only people that had access to like the kind of like internet connectivity that was actually useful for playing games were people in colleges or in offices.
Yep.
Like that was it. You know, I grew up in England. I went to a university in Manchester, and literally all we did was just play Quake all the time, because it was the only way to like get access. I remember at the time it was like a 10 megabit connection. It's called JANET, the Joint Academic Network. And that was like the only way to have like a connection that fast. It was like unheard of to have a connection that fast, because even like a T1, if you remember those things in an office, was,
yeah,
you know, only like 1.5 megabit or something. And here I had like 10 in my dorm room. And so we play a lot of video games, and because of the sort of, I didn't really think about this until like years later, but because of the construction of like who had access to this, to the internet connection, you got to meet like professionals,
yep,
or about to be college graduates who went on and did very interesting things. And one of the people that I met during that time was, his brother was a founder of a video game studio in Stockholm. And that company, I went to go work for that company. Like I talked for a bunch of time, and I was like a decent engineer by that point, or a half decent one at least, depending on who you ask. I moved to Stockholm. I dropped out of college. I moved there. We started working on a game that ended up being Battlefield 1942.
Oh,
and it was
sweet.
Called Battlefield 1942 at the start. Anyway, the company like very quickly like accelerated. I think it was employee like 8 or 9 or 10 or something like that. I don't even remember. But the company was acquired twice, like very quickly. Like another game studio called DICE bought it, and then EA bought DICE. And so that was sort of like my first foray into like the professional world. It's like, okay, you just like gather a small group of people together, and like people buy your company. And so that was sort of how I started. And after that, I stayed in the video game world for a long time, because that's everyone I knew was in that world as a result of like my video gaming days and my time at DICE. And I stayed there for a long time. I worked at like a sequence of startups that were doing different things in the space. But it was really all as a result of, you know, being introduced to computers through my dad, really, right? And I got in a lot of trouble with my parents for just, like, playing video games all the time and, like, formatting, like, hard drives and, like, installing operating systems. And just, like, it was just havoc, you know, because I was just so fascinated by it all. But it wouldn't really have ever started, I think, if my dad wasn't, you know, deeply involved in that world as well.
I totally agree with you, obviously. It's really fascinating. I mean, I've talked to, I don't know what number we're at. I keep saying 500. It's well past 500 founders, CEOs at this point. And there's this like common thread. You've nailed like a handful of them that I get from almost every one of these folks that have had a lot of success. And when I say a lot of success, like a lot of them, and I'm sure you're familiar with the company G2 with Goddard Abel. And he like cringes when I say success, because he's like, that's something you say when it's over. And I'm like, you know, it's not that. It's just like there's still continued success, but there's this ability to continue to drive towards something. And maybe Helium is it, and it goes on forever for you. Or maybe it doesn't, and you have one of those acquisitions you mentioned, and you go on to something else. And you just keep learning from what the past one was. It started off with your dad teaching on a program and having the unfair advantage of a computer at an early age that others didn't. And then that transforms into this gaming moment where you start to, this is just my pontification here, but you start to see the blending of competitiveness with talent, with tool. You start to see that you can use what you've learned to actually do this on a competitive level just as a gamer. And then you start to see like, what other things can I do with this that can make me better at what I already am? And it just starts to like pick up this snowball effect, and one after another, then you start to get the business acumen. You start to work at a small company, experience an acquisition, which I think is a really key differentiator among a lot of leaders I've talked to, is that early needing to be obviously towards the leadership end of the spectrum, but to experience the acquisition at an early age, I think changes a lot of people's brains. And I think it makes you in a position where you're sort of like a CEO type or a founder, repeat founder, almost in perpetuity, because you've tasted something that so few people will ever really experience firsthand. And that just sort of like begins to launch you into this world of startups and now, you know, obviously running the company that you're running. And I just think that there's a lot of preparation, work, and chance, and things that kind of come together to get here. One question I would have for you out of all this, and if you don't have to answer this, if you don't want to, when the acquisitions took place in the gaming company, that was DICE, correct?
Yeah, it was.
Did you experience any sort of, you know, reasonable amount of liquidity as a result of that, or was it you know, not enough to like set you up for life, or what was the level of liquidity you experienced?
Yeah, it was nothing life altering for sure, and I was still young at that time.
So but like enough for you to like take some chances that others couldn't.
I would say so. You know, and I think like it's you definitely are sort of onto something. I mean, you get some unfair advantage from all of it. I mean, like arguably, like my whole life is an unfair advantage. Right?
I would agree with me as well. Like I sit here and I look back on things, and I'm like, it didn't seem that way. I didn't think that. In fact, I actually probably complained a lot. And then in retrospect, you're like, holy shit, like these are things that no one else has experienced, or like no one had, like you had a 10-year head start with a computer. You know what I mean? Like that can't not hurt.
That's right. You can't even understate like how important that is. Right. And nowadays, like, you know, whatever this generation is called, the digital native, is, you know, different there, right? Like they've always grown up with, you know, access to Google and Wikipedia. And like, I mean, these are like transformative technologies. Like I was still old enough to like have an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
And for Encarta to be my first like experience of like what an internet could look like. You remember Encarta? And if you
I do. I
was,
in fact, I actually remember listening to on a CD, putting it into our old gateway computer, listening to Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech, and there's an actual video playing on my computer, and we were blown away because it wasn't cooked up to the internet. Like this was a thing. I was like, oh my God, changed my world.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. Like I said, it's really difficult at the time. It didn't seem like it, right? Like it didn't seem like a huge deal, but I think all of those are, you know, you're cheating almost, right?
Yep.
Like I had access to computer basically from age 3. Like I don't know that many people of my specific age, had that, right? And I think that allows you to cheat. And I think seeing what success looks like from an early age, even for just people around you, I think is also a kind of cheat, right? Because it lets you sort of visualize, and this is a weird sort of statement to make, but it lets you see what could happen much more tangibly than I think other people get to experience, right? Like you read about other people's success. You don't often like experience it very, very closely, even if it doesn't affect you as much as it affects like your friend or your roommate.
Totally.
You still get you see it, right? Like it's tangible and it's there, right? And then they go buy that nice car or whatever. And then you sort of realize like the connection gets made much more strongly in your brain. And so I think that's definitely like an astute observation. But it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult to like, you know, scale that, unfortunately. I think like access to computing now is ubiquitous, mostly ubiquitous. I think smartphones really transformed that. And I'm hoping, you know, like I'm hoping that the next generation, like we've just been talking about this, just because we have an Oculus Quest in the office that one of our employees brought in. Have you seen that thing? The
I have, yeah, it's amazing.
It's just like, I've used all the VR incarnations, I think, that had existed for like the last 30 years or something. And this one was the first time where I was like, holy shit, like
yep.
This is actually, like this is transformative now. Like I'm in a world, and it feels like I'm in a world, right?
Like it's like Johnny Mnemonic. It's a complete game changer.
You get so used to the hand controls like so fast, and I started to imagine what like education would be like with a tool like that, and like, you know, so I hope that like everyone gets to cheat basically in the future, because you know computing has gotten ubiquitous, access to knowledge has gotten so ubiquitous. I think we need to like, maybe this is too philosophical, I think we need to fix the higher education structure like fairly dramatically, like fairly quickly. But I'm hoping that like tools like that will be a really good way to do that.
I don't want to go down the path too far about the schools thing, but I talk about this all the time. I couldn't agree more. I get involved with a lot of Children's Foundation work on the side of trying to change. Listen, if the schools aren't going to do it, then we've got to do it as parents and or people in the community to provide kids of all ages and access to the ability to learn how to use the tools of the future, because I think the education thing is going to take care of itself rather quickly as a bunch of them start to fall into bankruptcy because they just can't afford to keep running the way they are. So I totally agree with you.
Not to belabor that point, but like when I grew up in England, I was the last year where higher education was free. Like literally, like my year was the last year. Like if you were born after me, you have to start paying for it.
Another one of those strokes of luck. Another one.
Yeah, a cheat. And I ended up dropping out of college.
Yeah, it's just ironic.
I feel like I was. It's stupid, right? I mean, in hindsight, it's sort of like some level of arrogance to the whole thing. But it's like the years after me, like including my sisters and stuff, like they were like protesting in the streets because they had to pay £1,000 a year. For their tuition, and now it's like sort of steadily increased. But yeah, just another one of those like you know pure luck kind of things that I think gives you an unfair advantage. But everyone should have that unfair advantage. You shouldn't be unfair when like all the information in the world exists already and needs to be like delivered somehow.
I do think it's the one thing that's perhaps even fairer than it ever has been in the past of history, because of the kind of. I'm misusing the word here, but like forced transparency because of technology, those who do not put forth an effort and take advantage of the tools in front of them will be weeded out faster. And I think, you know, in the past you could take a job and hide, and that's not going to be a luxury anymore. And I think that actually will result in more people of, maybe underrepresented means scaling faster up the world because it's just undeniable. You can't hide anymore. And that's one of the cool things I like about tech. As we start to move towards your actual business. One thing I wanted to highlight here was you talked about the acquisition piece of being able to, if not experience it yourself, all of the riches of it, but like being able to see it and why it's such a big difference. I totally agree. And this is how I kind of lead into your business. The thing that I've seen as being a part of an acquisition and then also being an acquirer of a company, and then again, getting that acquired. So like I've seen it enough times that what I identified as my unfair advantage after that, being able to see it the first time, was a lot of people I know look at an acquisition of, you know, name your company, $1 billion, what it doesn't matter how much money they get bought. People look at it like it's a mystery, like it's magic, like they won the lottery. They don't have any tangible takeaway that they can build on. Those that are just watching from afar, those that experience it firsthand, whether it's their acquisition or they're, you know, close to the top when it happens, have a nugget that they can use to reverse engineer success. And I think that's the part that is such a huge difference maker for people like yourself after having experienced early acquisition, even if you're just a part of the team and not the sole person, is that when you go out and build Helium, you know, whether your plan is to get it acquired or not, you know the building blocks of how an acquisition took place and how to reverse engineer your way from the final check swiping day to what it took to build to get there. You actually have seen it. And I think where you can make a difference.
I think the other important point there is that I do think people look at it as a lottery. And in some cases, for some people, it is a lottery.
Mark
right?
Cuban.
Like they happen to be in the right place. in the right Sure. Mark Cuban, not a bad example. But even in from the sort of founding and early employee team, like I believe there's very little luck involved. Like enormous amount of work that goes in. Maybe the valuations are luck, you know, to some degree, like it depends on climate and it depends on like, you know, all sorts of other.
Even that though, you're totally right. But like those are marketplace swings can be luck. But like the way you design your team to make sure that you're viewed as obviously your company is, but for others to be viewed as a tech company versus a name your type of company, the valuations could shift. You know, a restaurant company could be 4x versus a tech company that does the same thing for restaurant industry could be 20x. And that's strategic.
Yeah, and I think those are just like sort of arbitrary sliders, right? Like, was Instagram worth $1 billion and WhatsApp worth $16 billion? I don't really know, but there's still everyone's rich, right? And everyone's happy. But at the end of the day, like, the amount of work that went into like making them both successful is extraordinary. And I think it's very difficult for people that haven't been in the position of like being sort of a founder or CEO or any of those roles to sort of like understand like how painful that process is. And the best book for this, I think, is like Ben Horowitz, like The Hard Thing About Hard Things book.
Yeah.
I always relate to that the most when I read it, because it's clearly written by someone that went through all the different phases of like grief and sort of, and then ultimately like success at the end. But it's a journey that I think to describe as sort of like luck or a lottery is unfair to some extent. Like, I'm not a big believer in luck. I think you sort of force things to occur, and the luck part is really like how valuable is it?
When chance meets preparation. When chance meets preparation, that's luck.
Yeah, and it's a difference between like, is it valuable versus like how valuable is it? And I think that's where the luck factor perhaps comes in, but there's no luck in creating, you know, valuable things as far as I'm concerned.
I completely agree. So I want to spin forward into like, obviously knowing now a lot about your background and sort of how you got to this point. Let's just start with, what is the pitch for Helium? If you were pitching this in an elevator, and then let's start breaking that down, how you got to this.
Yeah, so we are trying to make it possible for everyday people to become network operators, to like act as their own telco. Like, we call this thing the people's network. Like, we think that the telco industry and the sort of wireless infrastructure industry is sort of one of the sort of oldest and most entrenched there is, and it's very, very difficult to like remove it or replace it with something better. And I think everyone has their own version of like why it sucks for them, right? Like, maybe Comcast is your only provider at home and you can't do anything about it, right? Like, you're just stuck with it. Or maybe your AT&T bill is like $180 a month and you don't exactly know why, and there's like, you know, 17 different arbitrary charges at the bottom of your bill. But then, you know, no one really likes their like incumbent provider, right? Like, it's the easiest industry to hate.
Yes.
And it's very difficult to affect it, right? Because the infrastructure cost is like tens or hundreds or even trillions of dollars on a global scale to build these wireless networks, right? And so what we're trying to do with Helium is sort of invert that a little bit. Is like, can we provide the like design and infrastructure and economic model that allows like any of us to act as a network operator and be paid for that, right? And the place that we're starting is focused very much on like low power things. So people often ask me like, what is a low power thing? And the answer is, there isn't really a good example, because none of these things actually exist, because there isn't really infrastructure for them. But the best example I could try and give would be something like Tile, the tracking device.
Yep.
But that works, you know, everywhere, right? So rather than only being near Bluetooth signals or being near your phone or whatever it may be, like wherever you went with the Tile, it might be able to track where you were. And you can take that further out into like wildfire sensors. Like, I live up in Northern California, and there seems to constantly be fires. And sort of knowing more about that, and just stuff that you felt like was supposed to have happened, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, that hasn't happened. And this is why, right? There isn't like good infrastructure for this stuff that is cheap and affordable and makes sense, because you're not going to pay $150 to put a sensor on the internet, right? You're going to pay like $1, or you want to pay $1. And so that's sort of roughly what we're doing, is that we want ultimately to change the nature of telcos and wireless infrastructure. But to start with, we're very focused on this sort of low power segment.
When I was reading up about your company, I was thinking of, we've got a couple of companies. We got one called Hologram here that's trying to make a little bit of a play in your space. Then we've got a company called Geobit, which is kind of the equivalent to Tile. One of my entrepreneur in residence was sort of like going crazy over your company, because he's like, this is so cool. And he was spouting off about Hologram, how it reminded of that a little bit of him, but like on steroids. And I came to him, was like, you know, the thing about businesses like this that I just absolutely love is that you can impact literally billions of people, whether it is direct, like me using it as an individual, or it's products that I use in an IoT sense. And it's a business that maybe, you know, I don't know, 80%+ of the population would never have a clue exists or why. and yet they use it ubiquitously and have no idea. And it's I mean, there's a reason that the investors you guys have invested the money they have in you, because there's just such a ridiculous potential.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't always approached the problem the same way, which is, I think, also why we're very well equipped to, like, try and solve it, is that, you know, when we first, so the company's like 6 years old now, right? So this is not, you know, we're not brand new. And when we first started, like, we had the same ultimate vision in mind, which was that we wanted to make it easier for, or at least part of the vision, like, we wanted to make it easier for low power things to connect to the internet. And some of this was driven through friends of ours, right? Like our now VP of product, like Chris Bruce, was starting a company called Sproutling, and they were making this baby monitor, right? It was like a little thing that you would put on your baby's like wrist or arm or leg or wherever, and it would tell you whether they were sleeping properly and that their blood oxygen level was good, and like ultimately would like maybe help with SIDS, and like had all these ideas for what Sproutling would be. But building the hardware and like connecting it to the internet, like in some low power way, was like practically impossible, right? Like you have to build some like Bluetooth base station to like tether the thing, or, you know, there was just all sorts of like bits in between. Like I have the thing I want to build and I have data that I want to get to the internet. And like we were pretty, I mean, me especially, like at that time, like 6 years ago, I had only lived in the software world. I knew literally nothing about hardware. And so I was sort of surprised by that, right? Because if you think about the trajectory of like software development, right, it went from being extremely hard, where only people in the know or people who had a lot of money were able to do it, you know, sort of back in the 90s, to extraordinarily like easy when it came to like things like Rails and the LAMP stack and like all this stuff that had gradually over time like made software development really, really relatively easy. None of that had happened in hardware, right? And so building hardware was still like impossibly difficult. It still is, right? Like it's absurdly difficult. Like I'm stunned every day at how complicated the most simple task, or what would seem like the most simple task, is. And so that was really like the thing. It was like, could we bring like some software? Firstly, could we bring software type techniques into like building hardware so it wasn't so hard? And then secondly, like, could we build infrastructure that made it simple to use that software, right? So if I build a device that was compatible with all of this, that it would just be online somehow, right, in almost like the same way that your cell phone is. And that was sort of the nexus of it. But it took us a long time to realize that, like, trying to build network infrastructure the same way that everyone else does it is actually a really bad idea. And we sort of ended up, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years, sort of inverting the entire structure of the business to say, like, okay, it's stupid to try and monetize the network infrastructure side of it if you have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to build it. Instead, like, can we distribute that or use the overused word, like, decentralize it, such that, like, anyone could participate in this ecosystem and share in the economics of it and sort of become their own provider of this network?
I think it's obviously not just novel, but I think one of the things about that that's so unique is, you know, a lot of these companies are run by fairly smart people. And if they had a way to figure it out, they would have figured it out. And so when you go back and you're like, oh, should we try to build this and we're going to do the same way that everyone else is building the network, obviously that's not going to work out. And I think a lot of people, the difference between those who make it to a point where they get to, let alone, you know, 2 years out as a startup, but like 6 years out, is that they flat out like just don't think outside of the box and figure out a way to use what's already there. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just need to reinvent the way people use the wheel. And that is something I think you guys have done exceptionally well. Maybe if you could provide an example for listeners on like how they will experience Helium.
As an end user, I mean, there's two ways, right? Like one, I mean, you can almost think of it like an Airbnb type setup, right? You've got the kinds of, well, I think they call them hosts, and the people that are like, you know, renting out their house, basically, right? That's one kind of user. And then the other is the one staying in the house, right? And our model is inherently very similar. We have what we call hosts. So the device is a device that we call the hotspot. It's a little white box. It looks similar to like a Wi-Fi router or something like that. And you turn the thing on, you set it up in a mobile app and you stick it in your window, and it creates, you know, miles of network coverage, or like literally miles, you know, from this little box sitting in your window. So as a host, you are sort of participating in mining and earning basically a new cryptocurrency that's called Helium, as a result of like having this hotspot sitting in your window. you also, as a host, get paid when devices use the network, right? So you earn both through mining and also when things use the network. And the things are sort of the other side of the user. And so those are, you know, the people staying in the houses in the Airbnb example. And those are, you know, primarily going to be enterprise customers, but also developers and makers and, you know, startups and everything in between, but people building devices. And so as a consumer of those, you know, as an example, like you could imagine the baby bracelet that I mentioned, or more tangibly, you could imagine a company like Invisalish, who is using our network to build a connected dog collar, right? And so as a consumer of the network, you are sort of interacting with it through the Invisalish product, but you don't really know, right? Like you have this little collar on your dog and it magically like sends stuff to the internet and that's it, right? Like that's your interaction with Helium, is that you don't know it exists, and that's great. So those are sort of the two ends of it. And, you know, in between are the sort of developers and engineers that are actually building products that use Helium. And, you know, we've obviously tried to make that straightforward. But our hope is that, you know, most consumers don't really even know that Helium exists and just sort of benefit as a result of, like, great products that are now enabled.
It's so funny. I just posted a little story about this on LinkedIn a couple of days ago on the gig economy and in general, like how I'm just completely fed up with like people relating the gig economy to like Uber and like, oh, they drive a car. And it's like, they don't realize that there are so many things in the future, maybe not today. Well, I guess in certain sects today, yes. But like for the future, people are going to be able to monetize so many things that they use as their own tools. And this is another example of it, those who can actually monetize their network host ability. And I think it's something that we're not spending, you know, the people who cover stories and things for, whether it's, I don't want to say press, but just those that are covering stuff, I don't think they talk enough about just how much of an impact, a global economic impact, companies like yourselves can actually create for people. Even if I made, you know, I don't know, maybe $500 a week, if I made that, you know, on the side of this, and in addition to other things that I do, how that can offset some of the things you hear about in the news about jobs that are going to be taken away by technology.
I think the other, definitely correct. And the other thing that I think is interesting about like cryptocurrencies or crypto networks, as people have come to call them, is that the participants like get to share in like the economics there. Like it's beyond just, you know, like earning a bunch of money on the side, right? Like they own tokens, which are sort of a relevant or a currency or a coin or whatever you want to call it, that are sort of the ownership interest to some degree in those networks, right? I mean, there is no other type of equity that exists in like the Ethereum network or something, right? Yep. Like, if you own ETH, like you are sort of an owner of like a part of the Ethereum network in some way. We've got to be careful about how we talk about some of this stuff because of, you know, securities laws and all of that.
But of course,
ultimately, like that's what I think is interesting, is that you are participating, you know, economically in these networks and sort of becoming an owner of the network to some extent. And I think that's a really powerful notion that is perhaps different to like the Uber, like current gig economy model, right? Where you're sort of paid an hourly rate and that's sort of what you get. Like in these models, like you are sort of becoming an owner of a piece of the network the more you do it, right? And I think that's a sort of underrated hack, right, to some extent, right? Because the only way that like ordinary people get to participate in tech companies is after everyone's already gotten rich, right?
Yes.
Like after the IPO has happened. And I think that's like one of the worst, like I hate the investor accreditation, I find the accredited investor stuff to be annoying.
Yes, I would agree with you.
It really means that no one can get in, right? And like no one can get into an Uber in the early days and invest the $25,000 that becomes worth $140 million.
No, yeah, I mean, we're big believers and supporters of equity crowdfunding and things like that, and anything that can open up and democratize the process of entrepreneurship, whether it's helping companies get funded or it's helping people participate in that. I can't stand, you know, again, that Uber model. Like some people will succeed. As I said, anything, there's always a portion. But for the most part, they're a tool. People who are driving Ubers are being used as a tool that don't get paid very well, and to create a driving network that ultimately will become autonomous and leave them out in a lot of cases. That's not really the successful gig economy model that you speak of. The other side of this is like the creators, which is who you're talking about, the people who actually create their own wealth, create their own opportunity as a result of technology. that is, to me, really exciting. And not to sound too altruistic, but I like the idea of getting rid of the red tie bankers in some of these cases who did neither help grow wealth nor bring value. They just literally were the broker who was, you know, accredited and entitled to monitor my money and take a portion of it for doing nothing, will be done away with. And those who actually are having the ability to facilitate transactions can make money. And they're, you know, they're actually doing something for it. And I think that's a really, ultimately a better world, put it that way.
I think so. I mean, you know, I go back and forth in my mind on the Uber thing, if I'm honest. You know, like, on the one hand, it's sort of an amazing thing that, like, you have this sort of on-demand work that you as a driver can do whenever you feel like. Like, are you underpaid? Like, almost certainly.
Yeah.
Right? There's no question, right? But on the other hand, it's actually sort of a neat thing that didn't exist before, right?
Like, oh yeah, I didn't mean it that way. I agree with you that 100%.
Yeah, no, I think we're saying roughly the same thing. But I talk to my drivers all the time, like when yep. I, you know, take trips, and it's always fascinating to like hear the various stories. But like in our case, it's like, you know, you could imagine like with the full evolution of like something like Helium, whether it's us or like someone that follows us or whatever it is, that your like 5G networking service would be provided by your neighbor or something. Right,
yep.
Like, why would you even want Verizon or someone like that involved if you could remove them? And there's a lot of steps before that reality becomes true, right? Like, there's all sorts of questions about backhauling and spectrum and SIM cards. You know, there's a million questions to answer on the 5G front before it becomes real. But you could imagine what that world would look like, right? Where instead of like paying corporations, you just pay neighbors and your communities and your local businesses and stuff like that, who happen to be operating networks, right? And 5G, I think, is the most sort of almost the most tangible way of thinking about why this is important. Because I don't know how deeply you're in the sort of wireless world, but you know, 5G networks are going to be very challenging to roll out because the range of 5G, you know, cell towers, for want of a better word, is very limited, right? Like, it's line of sight only. It gets sort of deflected and disrupted by pretty much everything, you know, trees, cars, buildings, even glass, will interfere with the 5G signal between your phone and the base station. And so the only way to like sort of counteract that is to just have a shitload of base stations, right? Like hundreds of thousands in a city, right? You can imagine like how many you would need. And so if you start thinking about that, and like the T-Mobile CTO like has been very outspoken about this, right? Like, he has this Twitter video that he posted where like he opens and closes like a sliding glass conference room door and it like interferes with the 5G signal. And he went on to say that like 5G will never exist in rural areas, like ever.
Yeah.
Because the deployment cost is just too high, right? Like, you could never make it back because there just aren't enough users of the network to justify like spend, you know, building tens or whatever thousands of base stations, right? And so that, to me, is like the best example of like why something like what we're doing has to occur, is that there's no way that anyone is going to build these networks, right? Like, they're only going to exist in like L.A., San Francisco, New York, you know, Paris or whatever, because it can only be the only place where they make any sense to deploy. And so I think that, and even then, it's going to be difficult, right? Because I'm not sure that the benefit for the consumer is that great at this point, right? Like, LTE is pretty fast, like, it's good enough. So is there really a justification to like spend billions of dollars like per city, like rolling these things out? And so that's when you start to imagine a model that's different. Like, what if, you know, your neighbor or you would buy like a $300 or $400 like device and that was the 5G base station, right? Then all of a sudden the cost structure is completely different. Like, no one is bearing tens of billions of dollars in cost. Like, individuals are bearing, you know, hundreds of dollars in cost,
which they can make back.
And then they, exactly, right. And as a result of that, they can charge a lot less for the service because they're already into it for a few hundred dollars, but I'm into it for like, you know, $1 trillion or whatever number. And so everything is different when you can structure it that way. But sort of to your point about like startups and, you know, like the only way that we can do something like this is by being willing to like give up on the economics of the network to some extent. Right, like we don't want to really like try and make money from the network. Like, we're not in the middle of the transaction fee chain, for example. Right, like if you have a hotspot in your house and a Lime scooter comes near your house and like uses your hotspot to transmit data to the internet, like that's your transaction, right? Like, we're not even there, and so that's a weird model for I think almost everyone to adopt. And I think it's very difficult, you know, to like make those kind of changes in companies. That people don't like to like make those kind of changes because you have to explain them to your board and your investors, and like everyone thinks you're an idiot, and some people quit, and you know, it's just a hard, you know, thing to like make a change like that. It's like totally understand why like most people don't do it, because it's really hard.
This conversation came full circle with that last statement, in the sense that we started talking about Facebook and Libra and how that could impact, you know, people understanding and applying and using or being willing to use cryptocurrency. Very similarly, you know, one way to adopt and understand and even be interested enough to understand blockchain is to physically enact blockchain, which is what happens here when people start buying their own hub to be able to let other people use it and sort of decentralize the way that the data is traveling back and forth. I think it's an important step, and you're playing a very pivotal role in the future of how the society not only works and makes money, but just the way that they learn the future. You know, the only way to really do it is to get people involved to make their own changes. And I think that if people could realize that they could sort of own their own, you know, network piece, their hub, if you will, I think that begins to also make you better understand blockchain and crypto and just the whole future of technology.
Yeah, I hope so. And thank you for saying that. You know, one of the challenges with what we're doing today is that there's a lot of education required, right? Because both on the blockchain side, because there's like so many scams and so much bullshit that, you know, trying to explain like how any of this works and, you know, dancing around the regulatory environment and using the right words and, you know, everything is hard. You know, you can't exactly explain things the way you might want to explain them. Even when you can, like, they're complicated sort of subjects to try and, like, distill into, like, simple terms, which maybe means you don't understand it yourself. Like, I agree with that logic. And so some of this is just really hard. And then the last part that makes it also hard is that we're talking about devices that don't yet exist, right? And so when people think about, like, what does a hotspot do, you know, they immediately think of, like, okay, it's just like a Wi-Fi router, right? It's, yeah, like, it's a replacement for an airport or an Eero or, you know, whatever device in your home. And it's not like that, right? It does no immediate service to you today, right? And that's a hard thing to sort of try and explain, is that you're trying to get people sort of rallying behind this cause that will allow this new class of device to exist. And so there's just a lot of pieces of education that are required in telling the story. But the sort of good news is that other people are also trying to tell this story, right? Like telcos are spending a lot of money on NB-IoT and these other like low power cellular protocols that are going after the same space. And so they're sort of they're also helping tell the story to some extent, because you're starting to see the TV commercials of, you know, the fisherman, and then there's a sensor on the fish and it goes all the way, you know, in a truck, and then it ends up in a restaurant, and then you end up eating it and it's safe the whole way because there was a sensor on it. You know, they are spending the money on those TV commercials and you're starting to see it. And so it helps a little bit there, because you know, other people are helping like explain what the purpose of this kind of ecosystem is, but there's still a sort of logical leap for people there.
I would say, wrapping it up on it, I think the thing that is, I guess, looks good for you is, well, aside from the business, is, you know, I think if you told people before that they were going to be able to be a taxi driver on the side, they'd think you're nuts. And how would I collect money, and how would people find me, and how would I know where to pick them up and drop them off and blah, blah, blah. If you said to people you could rent out your home or a room in your house and you could make money on it and you could have services that will, you know, clean the room and all this stuff, they'd think you're out of your mind. People are starting to really come around and adapt and learn. And basically, if you put a way for someone to make money in front of them, in particular, a way to scale that money and do it without any real disruption of their lives, they'd usually come around and start figuring it out. And so then it just becomes like, how do you make this a thing that people are like, oh yeah, I do this. And so I think a lot of groundwork has been set for you guys. And it's just like, yes, it will be hard like anything else, but you're in a very unique situation, that there just are not people who are thinking about this right now, at least in the masses, but they surely will be. And that 5G thing you bring up is like a perfect example of like that break point when people are like, or inflection point when people are like, oh, wait, this doesn't work. Like, this is right. Not what the Apple commercial said it was.
That's right. And I think the early adopters in any of these spaces like seemed insane, right? I mean, you're absolutely right. Yes. Like the Airbnb, Uber thing. Like Airbnb, I still could not imagine it at the time, like even after I'd seen it and they were starting to like get some success and like it was no longer completely insane seeming, I still was like dumbfounded that people would, you know, rent out their house. And what if people trashed it? You know, like, all the obvious things that, you know, you would go through in your head. Now, all of a sudden, I think they're the largest like hospitality provider in the world.
Yep.
And so it's, you know, you're absolutely right. And I think the earliest people sort of see that or take those chances. And I think as, you know, this starts to develop and people start to use it and more applications come on board, we've already got some good ones with like Lime and Invisalish and Nestle and Stay Alford and Agulus. Like there's a bunch of like good companies and good use cases that intend to use the network immediately. But as that sort of matures and like gets bigger, then it seems, just like with the other cases, it seems less crazy, right? Like all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm just like allowing scooters to like be found or whatever it is.
And yep.
It's a much more obvious connection.
I want to end on one note, and you may have said it in this whole thing, or it's something that you haven't said yet. I like to leave with a quote on like maybe the most important thing you've learned along this journey, stating back to your dad teaching you to code when you're, you know, 3 or 4 years old, learning what a computer is. What is the one thing, the most important thing you think you've learned along the way?
I think you actually hit on it right at the start, which is that like you need an incredible amount of like curiosity and like perseverance to do anything like this. And like constantly being curious about like, could it be done better? Could it be changed? Like, is there a way to do it differently? I think is really the only thing that sort of differentiates the sort of thinking at some of the best companies. I mean, like Jeff Bezos has this thing where smart people change their mind often, sometimes just because they've thought about something more. You know, no new data has been presented. It's just like thought about the old data more than I did yesterday.
Yep.
Or whatever, right? And I think that's a really important notion to like you're probably always wrong. And being curious about what might be better than the way you're doing it, I think is the most important trait to have, along with just never like refusing to ever quit ever is like the other sort of table stakes thing in order to do something like this.
I have forever run around with the quote, "My shit always works sometimes." Like,
that's from
Bad Boys.
I know
Bad Boys.
Right, from Bad Boys.
Yeah,
right.
I heard that as a kid, and I was like, that is going to describe my life.
I think that's pretty much it, right? As long as you keep taking swings at it, you're eventually, you know, you're going to hit it. And like Vinod Khosla, who's one of our investors, has a statement that, you know, most startups just need to stay alive long enough to get lucky.
Yep.
And I think
totally
that's
agree.
Another way of saying the same thing, right? Just keep hacking at it and eventually you'll figure something out.
Very cool. Where do people go to learn more about Helium or to follow you or anything like that?
Helium.com. We are fortunate to own the right domain. So Helium.com is the place. The hotspot went on sale last week. So if you go to Helium.com, I think /store is the place to go buy one. We are sort of, I think, relatively limited quantity. So like people who want to get in on this early should you know, get over there and join in. But yeah, most of the info is on the site. Like we're constantly updating and adding more. So we're pretty responsive on the support thing as well. If people have questions, happy to try and answer them.
Awesome. I really appreciate you taking all this time talking to us. This has been a lot of fun.
Same. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. You can learn more about upcoming Technoria events, investment opportunities. Check out the blog at technoria.com. Download the podcast on Spotify or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on social at Technoria, or you can follow me at Katoon. Boom. That's a wrap. Awesome. Amir, thank you so much. This was really one of the, I've had a lot of interviews. This has been one of the most fun I've had. I had the guy from Bird on just recently, and we got into some of this conversation as well about people flinging the scooters into the bay. And the interview derailed in like 3 minutes and just went down this path. And this was kind of similar to that, and I really appreciate it.